obviously Portland Parks and Recreation is bringing this action plan forward. I have indicated in my written testimony to you all of the reasons why this is so important, but that information has already been covered adequately and I think will probably be referred to later. So I'm going to jump right to two really critical points, more big picture comments, I guess. I want to compliment Portland Parks and Recreation for bringing this action plan forward. And I'd like to add that as the saying goes, actions speak louder than words. It's one thing to espouse the goal of creating a more sustainable city. It's quite another to act on that and actually allocate the resources to make that possible. So we're hopeful that you will approve the Park Bureau budget that will, in fact, make the implementation of this action plan possible. I was here about a week ago urging that you act on the proposal that was brought forward to you that will make the resources available to put this action plan into effect. Finally, and this is another big picture item, we want to especially compliment Zeri Santner and her staff for the high quality of work that this action plan represents. Prior to Zeri's assuming leadership of the Bureau, there was a little coordination between the Bureau's urban forests and natural areas programs. This is something we've commented on for a couple decades now. At her direction, the Bureau's reorganization created another thing we've been advocating for, a new city nature program. This is an action that citizens and many nonprofits, as I mentioned, have urged for many years, and we want to publicly thank Zeri for taking a leadership role in creating that new division within Portland Parks and Recreation. One of Zeri's explicit objectives in creating the City Nature Program, as we understand it, was to integrate the Urban Forestry and Natural Areas Program. We applaud her vision and, for initiating and addressing a decades-old issue by doing that. We believe that a unified, ecologically-based urban forest management program that explicitly seeks to realize one of the primary goals of Portland Parks Vision 2020 plan, that is the city in general, and Portland Parks and Recreation specifically, being good stewards of the natural resources of the city. It complements and helps implement numerous other city goals, as you've already heard. I hope all of you appreciate the fact that, A, you have a highly respected professional in Zeri Santner, who is a recognized leader in urban parks throughout the state and nationally, and that PP&R has creative ecologists in the form of folks like Deborah Lev, who presented this program to you this morning. And yes, planners, with the skills to produce and implement programs like the Urban Forest Management Plan and Urban Forest Action Plan. And we're very pleased to be here this morning to urge that you accept this. I don't know if you are technically going to adopt it, but we certainly hope you give it its full support. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Amanda Fritz, speaking for myself. And this is very exciting. This is an outstanding project that's been done. I hope you will adopt or accept the report and fund it. It's important for a couple of reasons. First, when the Urban Forest Management Plan was passed, many of us were concerned that it would sit on a shelf. And in fact, this is going to implement it. The process for having completed this action plan has been outstanding, with citizen review and then responsiveness of staff accepting and changing the plan based on that review. And it shows that the bureaus do work together well and can work together well. And I think that's really important to recognize. So I urge your funding of this on an ongoing basis. Having accepted the action plan, it's prioritized into things that are funded now, things that can be funded in the next 5 years, and so on. And so by accepting it, I hope that that is some recognition that this is a multi-year project that implements some of the values that Portlanders share in our trees for so many reasons, just the beauty of them as well as the stormwater benefits. And I especially urge you to fund the ad package that will allow for both regulatory and volunteer work in the plantings. We can't rely only on volunteers, although you should recognize that by funding people like Friends of Trees and projects like Environmental Services and Parks Do, you are leveraging millions of dollars worth of volunteer work, people like me and the mayor and others who've just gone out there and got muddy, to get these plants in the ground and then to water them. And so that's part of it. But then the other part has to be the regulatory aspect that, you know, we can't keep just going around planting new small trees because the large old trees have been cut down unnecessarily in development. And there are so many codes that do need to be updated. And I hope that you will fund the ad package. Thank you.
Thanks, folks.
Our next three are Margot Barrett, Leslie Carlson, and Shannon Locke.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record. You each have 3 minutes.
My name is Margot Barnett, and I'm very pleased to be here today as a member of the Urban Forestry Commission and also a member of the Southwest Tree Committee from the Sweeney Coalition. I'm very happy to be here to express my support for this Urban Forestry Action Plan. I feel that this plan is truly a positive response to the concerns that I've brought to your attention before about the city's lack of clear and effective regulatory and incentive programs that both preserve and enhance the urban forest. The urban forest serves many important functions that are truly critical for the sustainability of Portland as a city. We need to maintain and value this asset just as we value and maintain the built infrastructure of the city. The regulations for the protection and preservation of trees are in several different sections of city code and under the jurisdiction of different bureaus. Therefore, this multi-bureau involvement in developing and carrying out the action plan is key to being able to successfully simplify the code and the enforcement mechanisms to determine whether the regulations are adequate to protect trees and to identify the gaps in protection and necessary changes that will really make the Urban Forestry Management Plan an effective document and really make sure that we have policies that are working in the city. I applaud the effort that's gone into developing this action plan, and I urge you to support it. But I really want to have you keep in mind as you go through the budget process that to support the plan on paper is great, but we really need to also have that budget support in there, and that it's really critical that these participating bureaus have really been collaborating on this, but they've also been, they're submitting some budget pieces that really need to get funded, and if they're not all funded, they cannot work together to move this process forward. And so I really urge you to look at all of those pieces, especially the areas where they've indicated that funding is needed as you go through the budget process over the next couple months. So anyway, thank you very much for your consideration of all these issues.
Good morning, Mayor Potter, members of council. My name is Leslie Carlson, and I'm a member of the Portland Multnomah County Sustainable Development Commission. I'm here today to represent the views of that commission before you. We also want to add our thanks to the multi-bureau process that brought us this action plan today. Sustainability issues, as you probably know, cross over the jurisdictions of many bureaus, and we really see this as a great model for addressing many of those issues of sustainability in the city. There's a couple things the Sustainable Development Commission wanted me to raise with you today. First, we are also very interested in seeing the city fund the Urban Forestry Action Plan. You've heard about the effects of trees on water quality, on air quality, on cooling houses and businesses, habitat for wildlife. They also provide a very valuable way to absorb carbon emissions, which will help us slow the effects of global warming, which is something that we talk about a lot on the Sustainable Development Commission. And last, and maybe most importantly, they really do enhance the livability of our neighborhoods and our commercial areas. We also, on the Sustainable Development Commission, are working on a set of indicators that will allow us to measure the sustainability of Portland over time. And one of those indicators will likely be the health and the size of the urban forest canopy. And we would really like to ask that this plan include a process for monitoring the urban forest canopy over time so that we can go back and check how we're doing and really use this as an indicator of how sustainable Portland is. And last, because monitoring, protecting, and planting the urban forest canopy and trees in our city cross the jurisdiction of so many bureaus, and there are so many codes and regulations in the city that apply to trees, we would really ask that the regulations and codes be streamlined from a citizen and business owner perspective. If we want to ask citizens and businesses to help us maintain and enhance the urban forest canopy, it needs to be as easy as possible for them to do that. Thank you so much for your time.
Shannon Locke, Portland resident. I'm here today, first of all, to say this is a really exciting plan, and there's an irony in the report. Mount Tabor Yard is identified here on page 10 of the action plan with its beautiful, historic, 100-year-old nursery in full bloom here at the foot of Mount Tabor. And the plan For the nursery, we have been told is there is no longer any plan to grow out trees for the city, that all of this will be privatized. And this goes really against all of the studies that we've looked at that the city has done that talks about the economic value of growing some of your own trees, some of your own specialty shrubs, some of your larger caliper trees. Those studies say that it makes sense for the city to do those specialized types of growing situations. Not every tree that we put in the ground do we want to be a 2-inch caliper tree. There are problems with that, even though, you know, some of the current studies that the parks has done has talked about the value in 2-inch caliper trees. We have examples in the city where in urban settings, that's not necessarily a good thing because there's vandalism. These trees were at Atkinson. They were actually 4-inch caliper trees, and they were vandalized, about 24 of them. They were replaced with calipers twice that size to prevent that from happening again. It's unfortunate, but that happens in an urban environment. And so in some cases, it makes a sense to have larger trees, but it's not economically viable for all of those services to be privatized. So I think it's interesting that while Parks is presenting this program regarding our street canopy, they're also dismantling the employee base as well as the land to allow us to grow some of the specialty trees that have made the city of Portland what it is today as far as having exotic trees in its gardens. Many of the street trees that are planted today throughout the city started their life here in this historic part of the park system. So I would really encourage, while looking at this plan, to also look behind what the stewardship goals really are, because we are about to lose something with our brain trust in this city and the horticulturalists and botanists that have kept our system whole. That is being dismantled. It's not reflected in many of these programs, but we can see it in the documents that we have, and we would love to have a discussion about the reorganization of the Parks Department and how some of these things are a result of that. It happened without public input, and we would like that opportunity to reply to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The last person to sign up is Mark, I believe it's Bartlett. Mark on Southeast Yamhill.
Please state your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes.
Mark Bartlett. Good morning. I, too, was concerned about the elimination of the horticulture and the tree nursery at Mount Tabor, but I also wanted to bring up that there is a plan that's already developed by Parks for Delta Park, because we have heard also, it's a very recent plan, that they were intending to sell that property. They are using the reasoning that the CRC is going to have a ramp that will impact that property, so they have no choice but to sell it. Well, I've contacted the CRC engineers and the consultants, Evanson's Associates, and I found out that that's not quite the truth. And as someone who is involved in real estate development, I thought that the time that you find out a piece of land is a strategic piece of land and a major interchange, you shouldn't be selling the property. In 10 or 15 years, it'll be worth manyfold what it is now. So I thought I'd bring that up because I didn't know if the council was familiar with that. I've talked to former employees, and they indicate that this location is excellent for service delivery. So I found it curious that Parks was even going to consider selling this property at this time. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
That's all signed up.
Any further discussion? Call the vote.
Leonard?
I appreciate all the bureaus working together in developing this plan. It's a very, very important plan, but we also need to be mindful of funding the resources necessary from each for each bureau to make sure we can implement this plan. It is just one part of the process needed to make sure the canopy in the city has expanded to have a report, we also need to dedicate the resources to allow it to happen. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, this is a very good plan, and I want to compliment everybody who participated in it. Picking up on what Commissioner Leonard just said, I think it's well recognized, and I think the diagram that was shown to us points it out, that our tree code is fragmented, ambiguous, inconsistent, and in some cases, contradictory. Enforcement is almost entirely missing. And these are things that need to be worked on, and that is why the Bureau of Planning is requesting some $250,000 to address many of these issues to make our code clearer, consistent, and enforceable. These are all sort of the underpinnings of an effective tree policy for a city that prides itself in trees. So I hope that our as a council, we will approve this package and get this important piece of work going. And again, appreciate all the work and the performance measures to keep Portland a great green tree city. Aye.
Stan.
Well, thanks, Commissioner Saltzman, for this work, and Desiree and her team, and Chair Washington for leading the commission. I think it's interesting. I think we have a great reputation as well as accomplishments to rest on, but this really shows, I think, trying to get to the next level of sophistication and really understand what has to happen to protect this. And among the many things you talked about, we still, and hopefully will be joined soon by others, remain the only major city that's made progress on greenhouse gas emissions, and a very significant piece of all the technical work that shows that is the work to do tree planting over the last decade. And so I think it works on all these fronts. And I think it also is helpful for people to know that the simple act of planting a tree is a big part of turning around global warming. It's not the only piece. We have some biodiesel work to do and other things, as Commissioner Leonard is leading. But this is a big, big piece. And it also just makes us a great city. So I certainly am going to support getting the funding in place to get this next level of work done. And frankly, I don't think we could have funded it if you hadn't done this set of work. I mean, we could have put money in, but it would have done anything without the Interbureau cooperation. So thank you to everybody to planning and the whole team and BES, and I look forward to the next round of work and seeing the results of that. Aye.
Potter.
I want to thank Commissioner Saltzman, Director Santner, and all the good folks who are here today to testify and to work on this issue. I appreciate the cooperation and collaboration between the various bureaus. One of the things that strikes me about Portland as I return from a trip and I'm flying back in as the plane dips, and I see all the trees down below, and it makes me feel really good because I know I'm home. And this is something that I think is meaningful to every citizen in our city. We value our trees. I'm very pleased to see a part of this new charge is to go into low-income communities that don't have the same tree canopies as other areas. I heard it mentioned that perhaps the crime rate and tree canopy go hand in hand. I'm not sure I buy that as a former police chief, but I do buy the fact that in low-income communities, there is an underrepresentation of trees, and I think it does make a community more friendly and inviting. So I strongly encourage the continued effort to ensure that all of our neighborhoods are well represented and well shaded by trees. So thank you all for your great effort, and I vote aye. Please read the 10:45 a.m. time certain.
Item 235, create a local improvement district to construct street and bridge improvements from the Columbia Slough to Alderwood Road in the Northeast 92nd Drive Local Improvement District.
Per Commissioner Sam Adams, this item has been rescheduled to March 28th at a 2 p.m. time certain. Great. Please read item 252.
Progress.
On the regular agenda.
Establish $275,000 as a maximum price for newly constructed single-unit housing eligible for a limited property tax exemption in a home buyer opportunity area for 2007, according to Chapter 3.102.
Thank you. This is both a housekeeping item as well as making sure that a great program that we're updating will continue our progress towards home ownership. I'd like to see if Commissioner Stinn would like to make any comments.
Well, thanks, Mayor Potter. Every year we bring back the single-family homebuyer opportunity program, which essentially allows limited tax abatements on first-time buyers' homes. And I'll just say briefly for the listening audience, the council probably recalls that a few years ago we really changed this program from what I would describe as a distressed area strategy to a home buyer opportunity. And what that means is we're much more focused on making sure buyers who need the help get the help. It certainly, in most cases, revitalizes an area. But in the past, it was set up essentially in the 90s when real estate was very, very depressed. And when we're authorizing, as you can see today, a number of $275,000 for a home buyer opportunity, which is something I would have never imagined real estate prices would have become so expensive that we were pushing and pulling to help people get to that number. When we started this program, it was really nobody was building in the low-income areas, and we wanted to see some revitalization. Now it's much more focused on affordability. Last year, the council asked planning to keep track of how this helped families with children because some of our issues have families being priced out, and also minority home ownership. And I just wanted to report back briefly that it appears that about half, 48% of the units that were sold using the tax credit, single family units sold using the tax credits last year, tax exemptions last year, went to people with kids. That's twice the rate of the city households. Only about, you might win a bet on this, only about 25% of Portland households have children in them right now. So about twice the rate, and about 38% of the condos included kids. And about 45% of the units sold went to minority families, which is substantially above the average for the city as a whole. So it did help make progress in those areas. And so with that in mind, I think this is a very effective program. The money ends up directly with the buyers exclusively because that's who gets the break. Developers count on it in building the projects, but it actually goes directly to the buyers. So with that, I would turn this over to Barbara Sack from planning and with my obvious recommendation that we continue this program for another year.
Thank you. I'm Barbara Sack from the Bureau of Planning, and with me is Marilyn Hurtley from the Portland Development Commission. She's in charge of administering this program. As Eric said, every year we have to come to council with a maximum price for units that are eligible in home buyer opportunity areas for this program. As Eric said, this program is intended to promote home ownership for households that are at or below the median family income for the city. City code requires that city council establish a price cap annually. The recommended price cap is $275,000. The cap for 2006 was $258,000. This is a 7% increase. State statutes require that we set the cap no higher than 120% of the median sales price as of November 30th of the previous year for housing in the county where most of the city is located. This figure was about $250,000, and our recommended cap is 110% of that amount. We're allowed to go up to 120%. But we felt that that was too high. The reason that we've increased the price cap this year is that housing prices in Portland have continued to increase. According to Market Action, the RMLS publication, housing increased between November 2005 and November 2006 about 10%, and that was a median sales price of about $252,000, and it went up to $278,000. We also talk to local builders of entry-level homes when we're setting the cap, and they have also indicated that particularly land prices have continued to increase in the city and construction costs have increased somewhat. And lastly, we consulted our Home Ownership Advisory Committee about the cap, and they approved the staff recommendation of $275,000. I just want to point out that this program provides assistance to over 2,000 households who have purchased homes in Portland's North, Northeast, and East Portland neighborhoods. This program helps these households by lowering their housing costs for the first 10 years. They don't have to pay property taxes on the improvement value of their home, although they do have to continue to pay taxes on the land. And Eric has already shared with you some information that PDC provided us for the applications in 2006. So with that, we would just conclude and recommend that you approve this price cap. Marilyn is here to talk about developers' comments. and any details about administering the program, and I believe we have at least one person who wants to testify.
My name is Marilyn Hurtley. I'm with PDC. Do you have any questions for me?
I had one question. That is the geographic boundaries. Do those change from year to year as well, as some areas are no longer under the guidelines?
The Planning Commission reviews the home buyer opportunity area boundaries every 3 years, and generally what we've done is we've taken out the areas of the city that have improved or gentrified. Like, there were portions of inner southeast Portland that used to be in the program, and those were taken out. And then we add in portions that we feel are in need of revitalization. This was last changed in, I believe, 2005. We added in more areas of east Portland, and we took out some small areas of northeast Portland where incomes have risen and housing has improved. We also look at areas of the city where there's vacant land. So,
thank you.
And the $275,000, that's the value of the improvements that can be exempted. Is that
no, correct? That's improvements and the land.
Oh, okay.
Although the tax exemption is just on the improvements.
So the total package, okay.
Total sales price.
But just the improvements are what are abated, and that's
right.
10 years?
Right, it's a
10 years
abatement. Exemption.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions? Thank you, folks. Did you have an additional person, did you say?
Public testimony.
Oh. How many people do we have signed up?
Should we have one of our very, very fine developers who uses this and helps people get into housing, Tom Walsh, here? And in case you wanted to ask him any questions. Or did you want to say anything, Tom? No. Okay. If we pass it, you're okay.
Okay. Thank you, folks.
So we vote on it today?
Yeah, it's a resolution.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion? Please call the vote.
Leonard?
This is the kind of property tax exemption program that is smart and right and targets the right demographic, and it targets the right areas of the city that need this kind of infusion of public resources. And it's one that I've happily voted for ever since I've been here, and tried every time this comes up to distinguish my concern over other kinds of abatement programs that do not target these neighborhoods or these income groups that I can't defend. This one, however, I think is smart and absolutely goes hand in glove with Commissioner Sten's initiative to create more families and better housing around schools that are challenged in the city because of the drop in student populations that Portland Public Schools is experiencing. So I am very pleased to support this, and am very happy that we've raised it to the level that it is, because as high as that may seem, $275,000, it doesn't buy much of a house anymore, unfortunately. But it does give first-time home buyers a piece of the dream. And that's how you begin building equity, is to get your foot in the door, and this does that. So I'm really pleased with this program. Aye.
Saltzman?
Good work. Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read the next item.
Item 253, authorize the Office of Sustainable Development to enter grant agreements to fund organizations working to make high blends of biofuels readily available, creating quality local biofuel jobs and supporting Oregon agriculture.
Mr. Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. As I've been saying for the last year or so, petroleum is a non-renewable fossil fuel, and we need to develop alternatives. And one of the things I've been advocating is biofuels and ethanols, biodiesel and ethanol. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just imitating Commissioner Leonard now.
That's good. You did good. Keep going. I like that. That's good.
But last year, the council did establish a grant program of $735,000 under the Office of Sustainable Development to basically promote, accelerate the transformation of the local biofuels industry. And OSD did research options for investing these funds to maximize their impact and proposed two grant programs. One is a competitive solicitation targeting large infrastructure projects, very similar to our existing Green Investment Fund. And the second was a smaller grant program to support installation of individual retail biofuel pumps. We're here today to adopt an ordinance that would issue the awards for the first program, the large infrastructure grants program. There's some pretty exciting things there, and I wanted to turn it over to Commissioner Leonard before we ask Susan or Michelle to announce the winners. See if you have any words.
I actually have nothing to add other than this is happening exactly as I hoped it would. And Office of Sustainable Development has done an outstanding job, as I expected they would when I fought to get them the money. And the council agreed over anybody else. So you've done just what I was hoping would happen.
Susan Anderson, Director of the Office of Sustainable Development, and with me today is Michelle Krim. And the reason why all this seems to flow so naturally and so well after doing this stuff for 15 or 20 years, it's music to my ears to hear you all vying to be the lead on this kind of issue. And
one up in each other.
That's great. The ordinance today.
I was thinking it when they said it.
Pardon?
I was thinking it when they said it.
Yeah, I know you were.
I'll raise your green roof with biodiesel and see you ethanol.
So the purpose of this ordinance today is just to allow me to enter into the agreements and do the grants with the various companies and organizations. There are actually two different grant programs. The first, just to remind you, is for small grants to actually provide installation of individual retail pumps around the city. This will likely fund 15 new pumps around the city in the next year. The second grant program, as Commissioner Salzman mentioned, is called the Biofuels Investment Fund. It was a competitive solicitation targeting large infrastructure projects. There's a total fund of $450,000. It'll provide incentives for projects related to production, to storage, blending, and infrastructure, and also for projects that can further the development of Oregon-grown feedstock and supply. A maximum of $225,000 is available for any one project. We released the RFP. Excuse me. We released a request for proposals in December. We received 14 very competitive and very innovative ideas. We think a lot of them are going to go forward anyways, but we're only going to be able to fund five of those projects. We had more than $2 million of requests for the $450,000. We established an evaluation committee, which included members from the city, from the Portland Development Committee, our commission, the state of Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, the Oregon Department of Energy, Department of Ag, Oregon Environmental Council, and several different biofuels experts. We ranked the proposals, and actually we weren't going to announce them until next week. We have to do some final. We want to make sure we had the money and everything lined up first, and we want to be able to announce these next week. That's all right. You can all take credit again next week. I'll do that. the projects will really range kind of the spectrum all the way from the field to the pump. We're going to look at helping ways to enhance the growth of feedstock in Oregon, improve feedstock crushing facilities, produce biodiesel locally, improve distribution infrastructure, and enhance retail sales. So I just really want to thank you all for your leadership in this arena. If we think back to a year ago, a lot has happened. We have a new biofuels ordinance, which has a requirement for 5% biodiesel and 10% ethanol. We have now at OSD, we have good technical assistance. We're doing workshops, and we're providing hands-on help for fleet operators. And we have the grants, both large and small, to leverage innovation and to improve both the quality and the quantity of biofuels in Oregon. So thank you very much, and I look forward to being able to announce these next week. Thanks.
I'm just available to answer any questions that might come up.
Questions from the commissioners?
The suspense will have to continue for one more week.
We're all about the suspense, you know. Great, thank you.
Is anybody signed up to testify?
No one signed up.
So is this an emergency, or is this goes to a second?
I see an
emergency. I think this is an emergency, so that we can actually get the out the door and get the grants going.
So you don't have to wait. Okay, please call the vote.
Leonard?
Well, as I've said repeatedly, these combined efforts on the part of the entire council for renewable kinds of energies being used on a variety of different technologies or using a variety of different technologies. What are the names of the farms out on Foster?
Singer.
Zanger Farms, yeah.
I go by there all the time, and it's pretty exciting seeing the progress that is happening with that project, and which incorporates a lot of different kinds of technologies, including solar cells on the roof, the alternative fuels for vehicles. These are economic development initiatives. These are not just feel-good, trying to satisfy certain, you know, constituencies in Portland that think we ought to be doing these kinds of initiatives, notwithstanding they may not be economically viable. These are economically viable things that we're doing. And within a very short period of time, I think all of us here will be seeing that we're going to be creating jobs in Portland by doing these very smart things that reduce global warming, that increase economic benefits to Portlanders and Oregonians, by divorcing ourselves from foreign sources of fuel, by being smarter about how we use our resources. Portland is going to be a center of economic activity that actually will enrich its citizens by doing these very smart things, and we will be able to export some of what we're doing to other areas near us and create jobs. And the fun part is seeing this stuff unfold so quickly, and I really appreciate the work you guys done to really focus on what the really true benefits are of creating these kinds of industries. And it's very smart stuff, and I'm just convinced Portland will be a national leader in this. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I look forward to hearing who the winners are next week, and I wanted to thank in particular Michelle Krim for all of her work in staffing the committee and the whole process of making this happen. So thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Aye.
Stan?
Great work. Aye.
Potter?
Excellent work. Thank you very much. Aye. Read the next item.
254, authorize a contract with Kayenta Canada, Inc. for 5 years of maintenance services for support of the Bureau of Environmental Services and Bureau of Waterworks Customer Information System with the potential for an additional 5-year renewal.
Good morning. I'm Julie Shervey. I'm the Business Solutions Manager for the Revenue Bureau. And this ordinance provides for an agreement that provides technical support from Kayenta Utilities for our billing system that currently provides services to both the water and the sewer bureaus. The type of services that we get with this maintenance agreement are we move to what we call an e-support. Instead of having folks on in Portland with us, we move towards being supported remotely from Kayenta. This provides for those services. It also provides for problem resolution, any fixes, any releases that we need to apply to the system. And it also, and I think most importantly, the reason that you want to be on a maintenance agreement and have a product like this is that you get to take advantage as the company moves forward with their customer information system of any new development that they add to their package. So the maintenance agreements also covers any upgrades and enhancements that the company rolls out to all of their customers. So we would be able to take advantage of those as well. We have discussed this with the Water Bureau, with BES, with Bureau of Technology Services, and the Revenue Bureau, and they all support this maintenance agreement.
Questions from the commissioners? Do anybody sign up to testify?
I did not have a sign-up sheet for this.
Is there anybody here who wishes to testify on this matter? Thank you. This is a non-emergency and moves to a second reading. When is the second reading?
Yes, that will be next week on the 21st.
Mayor, since we're not going to vote, can I make one comment?
Sure.
I just wanted to thank Julie for her years of work on all these issues. I think there's a certain kind of public servant that almost never gets noticed and is really why Portland is great. Julie is the poster child for that type of person. So she's been working very, very hard through some difficult circumstances. I just wanted to thank you publicly.
And I actually, honestly, was going to say the exact same thing. And I didn't coordinate.
I was thinking it really hard.
I just happen to know that you have been the point person on this. You and I have met over the last few years on this, and I'm very impressed with your diligence. And every time I ask you a question that I tried to think of the most worst possible scenario that could happen with this billing system, you have a good answer. So I very much appreciate that.
Great. Thanks for your support.
Thank you, Julie. Please read the next item.
Item 255, create a local improvement district to construct street improvements from Virginia Avenue to west of Virginia Place in the Southwest Nevada Street Local Improvement District.
Good morning again, Council Members. Andrew Abbey, Local Improvement District Administrator. Before we get to this agenda item, on the advice of the City Attorney, I would like to respectfully request that we reopen the record of item number 233, which is the final assessment ordinance for the Southeast Dallas Street LID. I stopped by my office after we passed that to a second reading, and there was a fax on my desk from somebody that just wanted to provide some testimony in favor of the project. The fax was received in a timely manner yesterday evening. The person that normally would get this fax to me has been caring for a seriously ill family member, so this didn't land on my desk till this morning. Would that be acceptable to council to reopen the record to provide a copy of this to you?
Hearing no objection, go ahead.
Thank you, Mayor Potter. I don't believe we have any property owners here to testify on this agenda item for the Southwest Nevada Street LID. I just wanted to quickly cover one objection that we did receive. But before I get to the objection, just to remind Council, we had 78.9% petition support for this project. So we had very strong petition support. And I just want to show you one map that I showed you a month ago on February 14th. This is a map of the local improvement district, and the properties that tendered their petition support are shaded in green, and one property for which petition support was not tendered has a waiver of remonstrance on it, and that's the property that you see in the northwest corner of the LID, shaded in blue, which is a vacant, undeveloped property. That's all we need to show on that, Carla. However, I will just pass out a hard copy of the map so you can take a look at it. What the property owner is requesting is a reduction in their assessment for this vacant lot. Keep in mind that they own two properties in the LID. They've asked that the assessment on their vacant lot be reduced from $14,338.09 to $7,170. There is not really a specific mechanism by which this would be accomplished, and I do need to recommend that the objection be overruled. In their objection, they mentioned a break being given to developers on the street. I just want to note for the record that the assessments on whom I believe they're referring to on the developers, they actually, the two folks combined, have one assessment of $21,591.99. There's another estimated assessment of $13,585.22, and a third estimated assessment of $20,181.84. All of these estimated assessments for the so-called developers are higher than what is proposed for their $14,338.09 assessment. I might also add that the developers privately contributed engineering services with a value of $23,702.68, which is over and above their estimated assessment. So I feel very comfortable that the apportionment of benefit to the developers and to this vacant property are balanced, appropriate, and fair. While I respectfully do not view the Andersons' argument and their objection as compelling, I would like to take a moment, if I may, council members, to point out that the Andersons went about this objection, filing this objection in the right way. They have been engaged with me for well over a year. They have asked me good questions, and they clearly have endeavored to learn of the detail and logic behind the recommended assessment methodology. In short, they tried to learn what the baseline proposal was and put forth a concrete, specific, and actionable proposal. That doesn't always happen on every LID when you receive objection. My telephone conversations and an on-site visit with them have been both cordial and constructive, and while there were disagreement over the assessment of one of their two properties, the Andersons were open to compromise. They signed a petition for the property for which they thought the assessment was fair and declined to do so for the other. The Andersons clearly are an asset to the neighborhood as well. They have a beautiful garden and retreat on their undeveloped lot. That said, I must recommend an assessment methodology that is based on the highest and best economic use of the property, not under the premise that it will remain undeveloped and will remain a beautiful garden indefinitely. While I must recommend to council that the Andersons' objection be overruled by council, I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge your cooperation and the positive tone of their previous correspondence to me, of which I would like to provide council with a copy. So the kind words in the previous correspondence to me is something that I will remember long after whatever council chooses to do with the objection. Thank you. And also, I have with me some plans that show that the street does clearly go up to the vacant lot. It's essentially development ready, so to speak. And I'm not, again, encouraging or predicting imminent development, but there's no problem with them developing their lot once the street gets improved via this LID.
Are there different ways to handle the LID in terms of you know, if the council were to take some action regarding remediation for their LID portion for the vacant lot? Is there any way to pull it back in if it were to be developed otherwise, other than just a garden in retreat?
I'm sorry, Mayor Potter, I'm not sure I completely understand your question. I might say, though, that there let me just throw a couple things in here. First of all, council does have options, for example, to make a finding of benefit differently for existing development versus future development. I have to say I get really nervous about that because I've seen so many examples on past projects where somebody is just very supremely confident that the lot won't be developed and then it winds up being developed. And we really do assess on highest and best economic use. I think the other thing to which you may be alluding, Mayor Potter, is that there are various mechanisms to recapture assessments upon development. So it's kind of a deferred charge mechanism. The exact terminology for that is escaping me, but I think it's something along the lines of a reimbursement district. The problem is that we don't have any funding to front load or pay for the assessment of the vacant lot and then recapture it later. I would also just, again, note for the record that the Andersons' combined assessment on both of their properties is lower than a previous proposal that was brought here 2 years ago. So I'm hoping they've had a couple of years to plan financially for the street improvement. And, of course, any assessment will be eligible for 20-year financing, so upon completion of the project.
I would like to are these the Andersons back here?
I don't believe they're with us today.
Is there anybody signed up to testify on this?
No one signed up.
I would like to understand better their argument that they're paying for 60 feet of improvement while only achieving 7 to 10 feet of improvement.
I think what they're trying to allude there, if you take a look at the hard copy of the map that I provided you, the shaded area in the street.
Where's the hard copy of the map?
Oh, I gave it to Carla to pass out. If you flip over the page, I'm trying to save paper, Commissioner Leonard, so I'm trying to print everything double-sided. So I wasn't trying to foil you there.
Thank you for double-siding.
But if you look at that map there, you can see the shaded area is the area to be improved, and you can see that street improvement goes right up to their vacant lot. And so, I mean, if you look at the other properties in the LID, you can see that there's more frontage touching the area of the street to be improved. But this is not a frontage assessment methodology. This is a square footage assessment methodology. And, you know, again, the premise here is that the street will serve the eventual development of this property. And I might also add, I mean, the whole reason we're discussing this item today is because the developers on the south side of the street, directly south of the Andersons, they wanted to go ahead and do a permit project completely on their own. They're at the very back of the street. So if somebody wants to pull a permit and do the street improvement, they have to pay for it all the way up to Virginia Avenue. You know, it's not possible to just build the back part of the street. You got to build the whole thing. So I could also make the case that we should be apportioning more of the benefit to the property the further removed you are from Virginia Avenue.
So my next question is that they've said they should be assessed no more than $710.
It was
$7,000. Oh, I'm sorry, $7,170. What are they being assessed currently?
What they are being assessed currently is on that vacant lot, $14,338.09. So I think what they've essentially done is just split the difference and said charge us half. Now, the way council could implement that, if council chooses to sustain their objection, what council can do is simply exempt the appropriate amount of square footage from assessment so that they only get assessed on half of their square footage, and that would have the effect of reducing their assessment. Obviously, it would also have the effect of raising everybody else's assessment in the LID.
Including theirs on the other lot?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, including?
Theirs on the other lot. They have two lots?
Yes.
How much would it raise their assessment? It would be, that $7,000 balance would be divided amongst all the various property owners.
Well, you're looking at a $7,000 reduction out of $144,000. So if my math is correct here, you're looking at somewhere between a 4% and 5% increase on everybody else, including on their developed lot.
Why is that an unreasonable thing to do? I'm asking you, why would that be an unreasonable thing to do? Yeah, for us to agree to their request, why would that be unreasonable if we did that?
Well, I don't think it's inherently an unreasonable request, but every LID is predicated on assumptions. And basically what they're asking council to do is assume that their lot's not going to be developed. And that may be the case, at least short to medium term, but if I look across the street, there's two new houses that just got built and they have a value of just under $600,000. So notwithstanding the intent of the Andersons to keep that as a garden, I mean, if they both die in a plane crash tomorrow and somebody snaps up that property, that $14,000 assessment's going to look, I mean, assuming you don't change it, that $14,000 assessment's going to look really, really small if some future owner of that property put anything close to a $600,000 house on the property. And then what would happen is we'd be back here at the final assessment hearing with all the other neighbors asking, well, why did you cut a break for this now make up a number, $500,000 or $600,000 house?
Okay, I understand all that. I mean, that's not why I'm asking the question.
Sure.
I'm asking the question because the improvement does stop at the property according to this map. And it would appear to me that if they did want to develop the property, they would have to extend the street the length of or the width of the property for it to be accessible. So, I mean, you can't just build a house on this vacant lot, as you describe, and not have some costs associated with improving the street further. So that's why I'm asking the question.
Commissioner Leonard, if I may say this, I really appreciate you continuing to ask me questions until you get the answer you're looking for, because you are right on track as far as your question. And I would like to direct
you. I have a little tick. It doesn't allow me to get off point until I hear the answer to the question I ask.
No, and I absolutely want to answer your question.
Okay.
So not that I have a choice anyway, but I want to answer your question. If I could...
Pretty good job at it, Andrew. You're about the best.
You're going to start bringing an attorney with you.
If I could call your attention, council members, to Exhibit G, if you go to Attachment 3.
Okay.
And the question you're asking, Commissioner, is a very fair question, and it's the same question that I asked of Development Review when I received the objection to final assessment, because really the fundamental issue here is there anything left to do on this street in order to develop the property? And for the record, I, as LID administrator, have worked very closely with Transportation Development Review. So if you take a look at Attachment 3 of Exhibit G, let me just read to you what is stated in this memo. By the way, the author of this memo couldn't be here today because he's off on paternity leave, and we hope wife and baby are doing well. I have reviewed Mr. and Mr. Anderson's property, tax lot 12100, adjacent to the home located at 0407 Southwest Nevada Street, and determined that this property is developable and will benefit from the recently formed local improvement district. Actually, it hasn't been formed yet, but be that as it may. This property is at the end of the dead-end roadway, and when it is developed, and what he's saying here is when the street gets developed, will have the most benefit of all the properties along this right-of-way once the street is improved. Additionally, there would be no further improvement requirements required of this property at the time of development once the street is improved, other than the typical system development charges and driveway connection fees for new driveway access.
That still doesn't address the issue. The fact is that the project ends right at where their property begins, and they're being asked to pay the same share in cost that all the other properties are paying, and they have the benefit of having the improvement occur right in front of their property. So as a practical matter, I cannot imagine a case where an 800,000 house would be in the right range of the houses that would be built on this property? You gave a number. Was it 600,000. I cannot imagine somebody agreeing to buy a $600,000 house at the end of this street that they drove down and then have a gravel, street in front of their house. As a practical matter, they're going to have to pay the costs, I would think.
I think what might help, Commissioner, I brought along a copy of the plans, and I'm happy to, not sure what protocol on this, if Carla needs to walk it up with you, I'd just like to point to you where that driveway connection is planned. But I just want to be very clear. Once the street improvement is built, they have paved access to the end of the street. They have their paved driveway. They have paved access all the way onto the slot. Okay, so there is no gravel in the public right-of-way that they have to drive on, to, or some future owner of the property has to drive on to access this lot. I can show you the plans there if that would help.
I understand what you're saying. I guess I'm stuck on the part that they're paying for the benefit of having the street up to their property line, but it doesn't occur the entire width of their property.
Well, and it's just in terms of how benefits and frame, because this is more access to property, not access in front of property. I mean, for sake of argument, if the street went further, that would provide access to some other lot behind them. But keep in mind, the reason that we ended the improvements where we did is because they didn't want us cutting into the, not just them, but other property owners didn't want us cutting into the hillside. I mean, the idea here is to minimize the impervious area we're adding and the footprint of the street, so.
You said one possible exception would be to cut the amount of square feet that we would rule as part of the LID. At some future date, I also thought you said that we could come back and perhaps recapture that other additional square feet that we took out?
Well, yeah, essentially both of those options are available. I mean, as a practical matter, it would be much easier if you wanted to make a change. I mean, it would be far simpler from an administrative point of view just simply to reduce the amount of square footage assigned to this lot and then reapportion the assessments, including on their developed lot. I mean, that far and away is the simplest way to do it. I mean, it's not my recommendation, but obviously, as Commissioner Leonard's pointing out, you can make a case for that. What I keep coming back to is when I look at the recent development that's happened there. And by the way, one of the properties that we haven't even talked about yet, one of the developer properties, if you go back to look at your map there, the 0414 Southwest Nevada Street property, that property doesn't even abut a portion of the street to be improved. That property has a legal easement over another property to get to the street. So, I mean, if we started getting into arguing that you only benefit if to the extent that you abut the street, I mean, that property wouldn't be assessed at all.
But it does sound like we could come back later if that was developed and pick up additional LID revenues from assessing the full lot instead of just half?
I think what we'd be looking at is a reimbursement district. Absent a reimbursement district, once council imposes final assessment, there's no way to recapture it through the LID. That was one of the things that was in Measure 5 that was passed a number of years ago, that once a final assessment's made, you can't come back and reopen the LID and impose a second assessment. So, again, it really boiled down to either setting up a reimbursement district, which I